Here's a brain teaser. What do the iPad, the hamburger, and a cure for Ebola all have in common? I bet you didn't know they were all invented in North Korea. But they do call a hamburger a double bread with meat, and I'll have a wimpy cheese double bread with meat doesn't quite roll off the tongue, so one feels that's less of a win over American capitalism. You're listening to The Commute, and I'm Jessica Van Onselen. According to North Korea's official biography, their previous leader, Kim Jong-il, was speaking in full sentences when he was an eight-week-old baby, wrote 1,500 books just while he was at university, and scored 11 holes in one during a golf game. Take that, all you drunken, lazy students, 1,500 books all while you were playing Candy Crush in between tutorials. My personal favorite fact about North Korea was the government announcement in 2015 that they had discovered a lair, which as historians say contains the remains of a unicorn, or a dragon, depending on which translation you believe. Let's be honest, your ears definitely prick up when you hear a news story about North Korea. And that's because if you're South African, it's one of the few countries in the world where their politics are arguably more crazy than ours. And you just cannot get away from the Kim family, who dominate every aspect of North Korean life. Like the Kardashians of the Korean peninsula, only tubbier and with more of a penchant for murdering their enemies with rocket launches. But of course, like Jacob Zuma, North Korea is 20% amusing anecdotes and 80% creepy as fuck. Desperate poverty, gulags, and torture seem to define North Korea. They have no internet, and less than 3% of their roads are paved. Even your hairstyle is regulated. They have a list of state-approved haircuts. From 1994 to 1998, a devastating famine gripped North Korea, brought on by sudden drops in imports and food production and a series of terrible floods. It is estimated that up to 1.5 million people died in just those 4 years, with stories of citizens being forced to eat their pets, then bark off the trees, and in some desperate cases, rumors of cannibalism. But suddenly, coming out of the famine in the late 90s, North Korea seemed to have come into a bit more money, relatively speaking, of course. For starters, Kim Jong-il, Un's dad, began to build the nuclear program. After he died and his son had taken over House Kim, Un invested heavily in renovating and upgrading the capital, although admittedly the rest of the country still languishes in utter poverty. Gleaming new high-rise buildings were built all across Pyongyang. The North Korean elite suddenly began to carry Prada handbags. Cars even started to appear in the empty streets of the city. Where did all this newfound income, albeit modest, come from? Well, the answer might be a little more close to home than you think, fellow South Africans. Late last year, September 2017, the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime published an unputdownable report called Diplomats and Deceit, North Korea's Criminal Activities in Africa. I've put a link to it in the show notes so you can read it too. What becomes clear very quickly from this report is that North Korea is running a state-sponsored criminal network which spans Europe, America, Asia, and all the oceans in between. But this particular report lays out North Korea's illicit activities in Africa. Much of this crime is conducted with the support and in some cases direct involvement of the diplomats representing North Korean African embassies. And what an amazing list of illicit activities it is. Smuggling of gold, ivory, cigarettes, fake dollar bills, methamphetamine and prescription drugs, and rhino horn. Oh yes, you heard me. And rhino horn. And at the heart of much of it is the North Korean embassy in Pretoria. So it turns out this report on North Korea's dodgy dealings in Africa was written by none other than Julian Rademeyer, one of our own. Julian is an award-winning South African investigative journalist. He's written for pretty much every serious publication out there. He was founding editor of the political fact-checking website Africa Check and a senior research fellow working on wildlife crime and other issues for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, who are responsible for the report we discuss in today's show. A few years ago, Julian published the book Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade. You can read more about the book and about Julian at the website www.killingforprofit.com. But be warned, the photos of animals on that site are not for everyone. Julian is currently a project leader with TRAFFIC, the International Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, and I got him on the phone from Bangkok, of all places. Julian Rademeyer, welcome to The Commute.
Thanks, pleasure to be with you. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the history. Could you give us a bit of an overview of North Korea's history with South Africa? I'm thinking particularly the ANC before 1994, but after 1994 would be useful too.
Well, I mean, North Korea has a very long history with many African nations, and South Africa is one of those, although our direct diplomatic relations are a fairly recent development, coming in the wake of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in Durban in 1998. But a lot of this has to do with historic support that North Korea gave to African liberation movements, and that dates back about 50 years. North Korea was extremely critical of the apartheid government in the 1980s. In particular, it would regularly issue statements referring to the South African racist clique. And it also provided support to some of the liberation movements. That included military training in Angola, in camps in Angola. So I think much of the links that we have today, although they've faded with time, and the links themselves, I think it was Aziz Pahad who was asked at one point, why South Africa still maintains ties with North Korea. And he struggled a bit to explain that historical context. And certainly, South Africa's relations with North Korea have cooled in recent years, although they do continue. South Africa's response, for instance, to the United Nations or motions within the United Nations on human rights have been starkly muted. There was a motion in 2014 that was brought to take diplomatic and legal action against North Korea over a range of atrocities, including mass murder, rape, torture, forced labor, etc. And South Africa abstained from that vote.
Unbelievable.
Although we have consistently opposed their nuclear ambitions. And I think, I think also, North Korea, South African soldiers participated in the Korean War between 1950 and 53. So I think some of the ire of North Korea in the last couple of decades may also stem from that. But we have almost no trade links, really. I think there were estimates published by the Institute for Security Studies that in 2015 or 16, that our total trade was worth about $2.1 million. So it's fairly insignificant. And then, yeah. Interestingly, South Africa also, for some odd reason, sent wildlife across to the Pyongyang Zoo in about 2014, including two white rhinos and lions, a tiger, some caracal. So it's a bit of a patchy relationship. I think there's stronger ties with other African nations.
Okay, so you mentioned those two ill-fated rhino that went over to Pyongyang Zoo, and we will return to the rhino question in a minute. I read in your wonderful report, the last time there was a high-profile delegation, or the last time you mentioned in your report, was when a North Korean delegation came over in July 2016, and they met with Jesse Duarte, who I think at that stage was still the deputy Secretary General of the ANC, and then there were reports in the Korean Central News Agency that apparently Jesse Duarte said, whatever the situation, the ANC will always remember the Korean people who proactively supported the struggle of the people of South Africa and fully support the Workers' Party of Korea in its struggle for defending the sovereignty of the country. We will positively learn from the experience of the WPK, which achieved the single-minded unity that is stronger than nuclear weapons. Did Jesse Duarte actually say that, or did the North Korean media make it up?
Well, that's the question. I can't recall whether Jesse Duarte disputed that, but certainly official state media in North Korea are not afraid of putting words in people's mouths, and there have been some rebuttals to claims like that.
Fake news, yeah.
Yeah.
Possibly.
No, exactly. I mean, I think, you're dealing with news agencies within North Korea which are proper propaganda arms of the state, and ultimately their role is to try and further the North Korean state. These are the same news organizations that if, for instance, an organization within South Africa that supports North Korea puts a picture of Kim Jong-un on its website or publishes some of his writings, they'll issue a press statement. That's breaking news.
Fantastic. Yeah, that constitutes breaking news in North Korea. That's in statues, it seems. Okay, but let's fast forward to today. So as we are recording this podcast, there's a great deal of activity going on between North Korea and South Korea. I won't comment on it too specifically because these events seem to be moving a little too quickly for that. But we know that the North Korean state's in a pretty dire financial situation. I mean, no real international trade, as you were saying. Its commercial prospects are kind of terrible, and the UN has just imposed round after round after round of sanctions. We know that Kim Jong-un has agreed to sort of put his nuclear program on hold, at least temporarily, while these discussions are underway. But tell us a little bit about the current state of the finances of the North Korean state.
Well, that's, you know, that's another big question, because the North Korean state doesn't publish economic data. What we do have our estimates from South Korean authorities, and then a lot of the information is information gleaned from defectors. And, you know, it's very difficult in cases. I mean, I've interviewed some North Korean defectors myself. It's very difficult to independently verify that the claims that they make. But what we do know is that the North Korean economy has struggled for a long period of time, particularly since the famine that gripped the country in the mid-1990s. There's also what has developed over time is a fairly thriving black market economy. And, you know, the state has essentially turned a blind eye to those activities. But North Korea has been incredibly heavily reliant on China for trade and for support, and that's its primary trading partner. But China in recent times has been enforcing sanctions, and that has had its own detrimental effect. Russia also, which is another trading partner, has implemented some of those sanctions, although both countries are said to still be taking North Korean laborers. And that's another key source of income for North Korea is the export of its labor, primarily construction workers. You know, we found them in the past in Africa working in Namibia and Mozambique and various other countries. And, you know, people working in restaurants, North Korean restaurants. So that brings some money in back into the economy. People who are required to pay what is known as loyalty money to the state if they go overseas and work there. And then tied to that is the illicit economy and the various illegal activities that are fostered as a means of bringing in hard currency.
When we talk about the illicit economy, just a couple of the things that I noted from your report. I mean, we're talking ivory smuggling, cigarette smuggling, counterfeit US dollars, a hacking network, dabbling in fake prescription drugs. The list is just mind-boggling. I mean, this is a full criminal state that really doesn't care about any of its neighbors.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's the good question. Is North Korea a sort of family-run mafia state? And again, the estimates vary. I mean, there's some estimates which put the sort of annual amounts that, or, you know, annual profits from export of weapons, trading in drugs, counterfeit money, and other illicit activities at anywhere between 700 million and $1 billion. You know, some of the earliest cases on record involved embassies and North Korean diplomats in Scandinavian countries, for instance, who were implicated in smuggling cigarettes, counterfeit cigarettes, which is another money spinner. But it is an endless list. You know, you've got trade in so-called super notes, U.S. dollars that are counterfeit, that are meant to be so perfect that they're almost, you know, almost impossible to identify. You've got the significant weapons trade, the drugs trade, and particularly methamphetamine, which itself has had quite dire impacts on, you know, North Korean population in some areas. If you look at some of the research that's been done in the past, between 1976 and 2003, North Korea was linked to at least 50 verifiable incidents of drug trafficking. So it's a very you know, it's a very involved, very lucrative business for them.
So we know that they send or laborers work outside of North Korea, and we know that they have embassies in certain but not all countries. And we, of course, are lucky enough to have an embassy in Pretoria.
Mm.
I Googled it before the show, so it's 958 Waterpoort Street, for any of our listeners who are interested. And it just looks like a house. It has two white lions outside of it. But I think that that benign-looking gate probably conceals a much more complicated interior. What do we know about the North Korean embassy in Pretoria?
Well, there's a volleyball court in front in the driveway. You know, for the most part, the diplomats there remain fairly cloistered. I tried at various stages to speak to them, get comment from them. You know, in one instance, I eventually just turned up on their front doorstep with a cameraman, tried to get comments. Their reaction was quite extreme. You know, there was violent threats. One of the security people eventually sort of kicked the gate when he saw me filming them. There were two rather bored Alsatians
inside. And it was
quite
a big dog.
Yeah, two.
Yeah, I saw the dogs.
Yeah, the Alsatians were quite friendly. I think they were confused about what all this aggression was about, and they had a ball that they wanted to play with. And, you know, then they started pelting my car with stones, little pebbles, in a bid to get me to leave. So time and time again, they've been approached about various allegations leveled against them. Reporters who've looked into this and essentially been strung along. No hard comments, occasionally a sort of a no comment, but no one really prepared to sit down and have a discussion. That embassy, though, is quite integral in North Korean diplomatic activities in southern Africa, particularly in Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Mozambique. Relations with Botswana were effectively severed in 2014, relations with some of the other countries are cooling. But it's this embassy that was implicated in an incident in May 2015, when one of its diplomats was caught in Mozambique with rhino horn.
Well, not just rhino horn, 4.5 kilograms of rhino for horn and $100,000 in cash, right? And the Toyota Fortuna that they were all in Mozambique was registered to the actual Praetorian embassy. So that begs the question, is the North Korean embassy in South Africa implicated in rhino poaching and the trade of rhino horn?
Well, it's definitely implicated in trafficking rhino horn. And that incident was, appears not to have been an isolated incident. That was one of the rare cases where hard evidence was found. In this particular instance, a North Korean diplomat, Pak Chol Jun, who held quite a senior role in the embassy, and a taekwondo master who'd been living in South Africa for some time and was reputed at one stage to be a North Korean spy, Kim Jong-soo, were detained in Maputo. As you said, $100,000 in cash and 4.5 kilograms of rhino horn was found in their vehicle. The North Korean ambassador subsequently flew to Maputo, and they were released. There are some conflicting stories that they either paid a fine or a bribe, and they were allowed to go. And returned to South Africa. And then South Africa ultimately intervened. The Ministry of International Relations gave the diplomat, Pak, 30 days to leave South Africa, or be PNG'd, is the term, declared persona non grata. And the taekwondo master left South Africa telling acquaintances here that he was returning home to visit his family. And as far as we know, he hasn't returned.
I know that in May 2015, we were quite in the grip of the fees must fall. There was a lot going on in the country, but I don't recall. I mean, I'm quite interested in North Korea, and I don't really recall a huge media splash about this. I was just thinking, what happened if the British ambassador was caught on holiday on the South Coast with 4.5 kilos of rhino horn? It's kind of amazing that this stuff wasn't headlines for days.
No, exactly. I mean, that story petered, or emerged quite slowly. There was an initial report about a month later, published by United Press International by one of their South Korean correspondents, which gave some details about the incident. But the South African authorities kept it quiet for a long period of time. I eventually started asking questions in around December of that year. And it was only then that I finally, after much persuasion, managed to get confirmation from the Ministry of International Relations that the incident had been that they had looked into the incident, and that the steps that they were taking were to declare this particular diplomat, will give him the opportunity to leave the country. But that incident is part of an ongoing incident, particularly in relation to the trade in rhino horn and ivory. Research that I did at the time for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, going through news reports and open source information dating back to 1986, identified 31 cases of rhino horn and ivory smuggling involving diplomats from various countries. But what was quite a surprise is that 18 of those cases involved North Korean diplomats. And, you know, we'd known North Korean activity in the rhino horn and ivory trade was quite well documented, particularly by the Environmental Investigation Agency in Zimbabwe in the late 1980s. But again, that was seen almost as an aberration, as something that was going on in Zimbabwe itself. EIA subsequently produced a report in which they said that the Zimbabwean embassy was involved and massively involved in the illegal trade in rhino horn and ivory. And Zimbabwe subsequently shuttered those embassies. Zambia did the same thing. This is something that has been going on for a very long time, and it seems that this activity is still going on. The most recent incidents that I've managed to document occurred in September and October 2016, when two North Korean nationals traveling on diplomatic passports were detained on separate occasions at Bole International Airport in Ethiopia. Both of them were en route to China. One of them was found with just over 70 pieces of worked ivory in his possession. And then the other, who was arrested about a month later, was found with around 200 ivory bangles in his possession. And what's interesting, that in that particular case, the man's name was Kim Chang-soo, and he appeared to be a North Korean trade representative in Harare. And just recently, last week, the Zimbabwean newspaper Newsday managed to track him down. He's still active in Zimbabwe. He's still their primary trade person there. He denied all the allegations and claimed that it was fake news, although admitted that the name was correct and the title was correct. That incident again shows how reluctant officials are, the Ethiopian incident, show how reluctant officials are to take action when they discover that people are diplomats and that they're involved in smuggling.
It shows reluctance, but I think it also shows that there must be huge amounts of money at play to continue this high-risk behavior, which leads to the question, so who is getting rich off this illegal trade? I mean, not just the rhino horn, the whole, the drugs, the counterfeit dollars. Who's getting rich and who's not getting rich?
Well, I think in some ways it's not entirely that simple. I mean, I think that, overall there's a reluctance from law enforcement officials to take action against diplomats. You know, we've seen that in South Africa when Vietnamese diplomats have been implicated in smuggling rhino horn. The generally preferred route is to quietly let them go and, write a formal letter of complaint to the embassy and say, this person should leave the country. And I think the customs officer or the policeman or whatever that is going to arrest a diplomat once they know that they are a diplomat and have seen their credentials is a rare individual. These are the people that are involved at airports are often fairly low-level officials, and they've all got bosses, and the bosses tend to frown on diplomatic incidents that could have an impact. In terms of who's getting rich, I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. Diplomats, North Korean diplomats are incredibly poorly paid. Generally an ambassador would be paid around $1,000 a month. Officials within the embassy would be paid significantly less. And the embassies are expected to be, almost self-sustaining, to create their own opportunities to set up businesses. So the Pretoria Embassy, for instance, at one stage was involved in a pretty terrible North Korean restaurant in the east of Pretoria, which they set up.
Did you eat there?
I didn't get the chance. I tried, but they had closed down. This was shortly after this incident. Exactly. But their restaurant reviews on Facebook and elsewhere are pretty terrible. But one of the reasons for that is that they were unable to bring in North Korean chefs. The Department of International Relations flatly refused to issue work permits to the chefs that they wanted to bring in. So they trained some South Africans to work in the kitchen, and I think it was an Afrikaans guy who ran the restaurant. And, you know, they had various specials at various times, but people clearly weren't biting. But they've, you know, it's those sorts of businesses. I think, you know, at one stage in Zambia, they were renting out the embassy minibus as a taxi to make extra money. And conditions were so dire, this was in the 1980s, that when they held an embassy function, the diplomats had to actually leave the embassy and go and catch fish in a river to try and feed their guests because they simply didn't have the money to bring food in. So, you know, and we constantly hear these stories from some of these embassies and from defectors that they live in, you know, close confines. You know, sometimes all they can afford is rice or, you know, some basic staple. So money is a big issue. So this helps to pad their incomes. In some cases, these, you know, some of the diplomats and also other North Koreans working abroad are trying to save up money to take back to their families in addition to paying loyalty money to the state. And there was one particular individual I interviewed, a defector, who had spent some time working as a sort of middleman import-export type for North Korea based in China. And he, you know, he spoke about trying not to declare too much income from his business. You know, the business that he was running, the front company he was running, this import-export business, was doing pretty well. But he would only declare, you know, X amount of income because he'd be required to pay more and more loyalty money. So it was better for him to under-declare how well the business was doing, and then he could line his own pockets. So, you know, I think for many of those people, it's a fairly stark choice.
So it's not actually the sort of lavish ambassadorial lifestyle one sometimes think. I mean, sometimes these people live in absolutely dire conditions, it sounds like.
No, exactly. You know, it's I think, you know, some of the, depending on the seniority and depending where the diplomats are based, some of them live better off than others. But, you know, many of the diplomats living in African countries are not living in particularly great conditions.
So you mentioned you have had a chance to speak to a number of North Korean defectors, which must be an amazing experience. And they seem to just carry with them the most shocking and horrifying stories, which are finally starting to get out. We're starting to capture those, and they'll be reflected in history, I think. You tell a great slash horrifying story in your report about a North Korean, I think it was a biophysicist, and he was responsible for researching the sorts of goods that Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's late dad, the previous one, was eating, and that eating quote-unquote exotic goods was meant to help with this. is that code for sex stuff?
Well, some of it seems to have been that. You know, he worked for a very special sort of section which was meant to look after the leader's health and the health of his family. And it was a scientific, it was the Mansumugang Institute, also known as the Long Life Health Institute. And it was staffed by dozens of scientists, and their job was essentially to keep the leader alive for as long as possible and look at various types of things. So that included the exotic foods that you mentioned to help boost his sexual performance. And apparently, according to some of the more salacious reports and claims that made, these included the reproductive organs of lions from Africa and seals. And that's something that, you know, Kim Jong-soo, the biophysicist who escaped, you know, and he'd been quite badly tortured. His mother had been reportedly tortured to death in a prison camp. And he fled to South Korea, and these were some of the stories that he told. He said that rhino horn, which wasn't readily available, was something that was used by the more affluent members of society, many, senior government officials, ministers, etc., because it was believed to cure certain types of cancer.
It's amazing to hear these stories. So we've sort of touched on perhaps government's reluctance or hesitance to confront diplomats and make diplomatic relations difficult. But what about Interpol? I mean, what is the international community's appetite for cracking down on this illicit economy and clamping down on the drugs and the dollars and the cigarettes, etc.?
Well, I think there's certainly appetite from countries like the United States. Interpol itself is not a police agency. It acts as an international body for law enforcement agencies to share information and so on. So, Interpol can't charge in and start arresting people, but it certainly can facilitate that exchange of information. Again, I think it
especially
comes,
if it's cross-border, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if it is about flowing from South Africa to Ethiopia to China, all facilitated by North Korean mules, that would be an Interpol conversation, I imagine.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, but again, you have the problem that you have with any transnational organized crime is it's about political will of Interpol member states. Mm. It's about trying to tackle organizations or entities or people who operate quite easily across borders, whose tentacles span the globe in some cases, and who use the fact that they operate across multiple legal jurisdictions to their advantage. And these are also, like any good business, these are businesses. Their job is to get a product from A to B. Like anything like that, they are very adept at circumventing regulations or rising to challenges. If one smuggling method is discovered, a new one will emerge and emerge pretty quickly. It's a phone call away to change your methods, to change your routes, to change the way that you're doing business. Many of the sort of agents and smugglers there, and I think, the same is probably true with some of these diplomats, are pretty expendable. Once they, if someone does get caught and arrested and convicted, they can very quickly be replaced. I do think that many countries, particularly countries that have taken a softer approach to North Korea, countries that do have long-standing relations with North Korea and a degree of gratitude for the support that they received from North Korea, particularly in Africa in the liberation struggles, are reluctant to take action. And then beyond that, you also have your police officials who don't really want to cause a diplomatic incident. I mean, for many of these diplomats, it is almost an opportunity to commit the perfect crime. But the key thing to remember is that the Vienna Convention, which bestows diplomatic privilege on diplomats, is not and was never intended as a get-out-of-jail-free card, and is quite specific that diplomatic bags, which can take any form. And a diplomatic bag can be a suitcase or it can be a container that's covered by diplomatic privilege. But they may only contain diplomatic documents or articles that are intended for official use. And it does allow for diplomats' bags to be searched, which they'd usually be exempt from inspection. But they can be searched if there are serious grounds for presuming that they don't contain official articles or that they're importing or exporting prohibited items or items that are controlled by quarantine regulations. The only requirement then is that the diplomat or representative is present when that inspection is carried out. So there is an opportunity to tackle this. Whether that would lead to prosecutions, some countries have been particularly hard-hitting. Germany has arrested North Korean diplomats arrested a North Korean diplomat and put him and his wife on trial for smuggling across the border. But, in that instance, they weren't accredited in that country. They were accredited in a neighboring country. So, again, it just depends on whether customs officials, etc., will risk the wrath of their superiors or their governments.
Julian, have you been to North Korea?
No. The closest I've been is to the border with North Korea. But I think it would be a fascinating trip.
Please don't go. Just a request from me. I don't think it's a, you have lots of good ideas, but that's not one of them. All right. We're coming to the end. I ask all my guests this. If our listeners want to learn a little bit more about North Korea, a little bit more about North Korea and South Africa, are there any resources that you would recommend they go and find?
Well, there are a couple of great websites that document news about North Korea and have looked at some of these specific issues. One is nknews.org. There's also North Korea Economy Watch, which looks at and does some very insightful analysis around economic developments within North Korea. There's a very good report which was published a couple of years ago by a U.S. Researcher, Sheena Chestnut-Greitens, called Illicit, which goes into a lot of detail about North Korean illicit activities, particularly around the drugs trade. And there's also research by Benjamin R. Young, also a U.S.-based researcher who's been looking at North Korean ties with Africa. And then finally, there's a Professor Andrei Lankov, who's based in South Korea, but who studied in North Korea and has written some very insightful books about North Korea that strip away some of the myths that have spread. His most prominent one is a book called Real North Korea. I think North Korea in many ways has been demonized to such an extent that, you know, we tend to grab onto the crazier stories. And, in some cases, some of the tales told by defectors, and that's why defector testimonies need to be treated with caution and verification should be attempted. Some of the wilder stories that have been told have proved to be false. So I think it's very easy to create a sort of us and them thing where North Korea is entirely demonized and there's very little effort to try and understand what's going on and what the thinking processes are, and to portray, Kim Jong-un as this cartoon type character. I think there's a lot more nuance at play. There's a lot more going on. I'd recommend checking out all of those.
Great. I'll put the links to that in the show notes, listeners. Another book that I really enjoyed when you talk about humanizing the North Korean experience was Barbara Demick's Nothing to Envy.
That's an exceptional book. Gosh,
almost 10 years ago, but just human stories on a personal level of life in North Korea, the ups as well as the downs, and there are ups. So, yeah, that's a really beautiful book as well.
It's an outstanding book, yeah.
Julian Rademeier from Bangkok, we really appreciate you doing the podcast late at night. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
No, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to The Commute, the podcast that brings you big ideas from a South African perspective.